If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there, and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Whether you're making a delicious family meal or a post-workout snack, choose the farm-fresh taste of Eggland's Best Eggs. Only Eggland's Best Hens are fed their proprietary all-vegetarian feed. That's what makes their eggs more nutritious. With 10 times more vitamin E, 25% less saturated fat, and 6 times more vitamin D compared to ordinary eggs. Eggland's Best. Better taste, better nutrition, better eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com to learn more.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. For today's episode, we've got a conversation about the recent history of Wales with journalist and author Simon Jenkins, who's also the presenter of an upcoming BBC Radio 4 programme, Wales, a 20th Century Tragedy. Jenkins argues that the story of Wales in the 20th century is one of economic decline and resentment. In this discussion, he explores why he feels the country has lost its way and offers his opinions on its future. Our deputy digital editor, Eleanor Evans, met up with Simon at his home in London to find out more.
Your upcoming programme, Wales, a 20th Century Tragedy, explores what you frame as the decline of Wales in a certain way. What can you tell us about that tragedy as you mean it here?
I think what I mean by this rather controversial title is that my experience of Wales, which is the land of my father, is that it was, through much of its history, right back to the Middle Ages, a very prosperous part of the British Isles. It had extraordinary natural resources, and it had those resources right through the 20th century. And it benefited from them. It was far less poor than Ireland or Scotland, or much of the north of England or the west of England. And it was less poor because it had sheep, it had fertile valleys, it had fertile uplands. It had stock. It supplied England with milk. It also had slate, iron, lead, zinc, all these minerals, which it exploited successfully. It then had coal, which it exploited very successfully. It had a very lively fabric industry, and it had a lot of tourism. It was a beautiful place. Nothing in Wales, with the possible exception of the coal, needed, so to speak, to collapse, needed to go. It was as well placed to do very well as as Yorkshire, for instance, as East Anglia, Southeast England, or the Midlands. Why is it not that way today? That's what fascinates me.
So looking particularly at coal then, what was it about this industry for listeners who might not, you know, be aware, oddly enough, about that this part of Welsh history? What was it about coal that exploded or had exploded at the beginning of the 20th century?
Well, coal was needed by the entire world. Welsh coal was extremely good. Coking coal was ideal for long distance ships. It was simply black gold. And it was produced by huge areas of Glamorganshire. And Glamorganshire was, for probably 60, 70, 80 years, by far the richest county in Britain. It was doing very well. And the civic centre of Cardiff, the valleys, the ports and docks were all centres of wealth. This wealth was not stolen by the English. It was Welsh wealth. Most of it stayed in Wales. My father's streets in Merthyr and Dowlais were infinitely more substantial, well-built and nice to live in than the ones he went to as a young man in, for instance, Bradford or in Lancashire, where he was appalled at the living conditions of the working class. Wales really was a very classy place. And I think in many ways it sort of forgets that by moaning too much.
Can you say a bit more about how it forgets it, in your opinion?
Well, I've read the figures. I can see that Wales really is now one of the poorest regions of the British Isles. It's almost as poor as Northern Ireland. And it's almost as dependent on central government as Northern Ireland is, which is pretty bad news. I'm just puzzled by this. Whether it's, one mustn't put the cart before the horse. Undoubtedly, Welsh politics has developed a language of resentment and grievance, which is ingrained in Welsh politics. And I've read so much about it, and I wouldn't get quite as far as Thomas's worrying the carcass of a dead song, but there's something about that phrase that does apply to Welsh politics. Time and again, and I sat on committees occasionally and so on, the Welsh component is simply give us a grant. The phrase give us a grant, I mean, it should be the motto of the Welsh dragon. And it's bad news. It doesn't do you good. It actually ultimately makes you dependent and does you harm. And of course, when you don't get the grant, it means the colonial power is against you. This whole psychology, I think, is very unhelpful. I wouldn't put any stronger than that, but it's very unhelpful. And I just do believe that if Wales is to prosper, as I still think it can, because it has so many advantages still, it's got to snap out of that sense of grievance and dependency.
So how did we first see in this period that you're looking at these resentments or grievances playing out politically in this period?
Well, Welsh nationalism was always seen, always. It didn't really exist after Glyndŵr. But it was largely cultural, and it was bred of Saunders Lewis and people like that. It was bred of a rediscovery in many ways of Welsh linguistic culture and literary culture, and that was splendid and wonderful and no problem. The fact that the first Gorsedd took place on Primrose Hill in London is a curiosity, but nonetheless, Wales is very good at protecting its culture. And it's a very fine culture. I don't speak Welsh, but I do read it in translation, so to speak. And there's no problem with that. The trouble began, I think, really with the Depression. The Depression hit Wales very hard because the price of coal collapsed. And in a sense, nothing happened in Wales. It was any different from what happened in South Yorkshire or in Nottinghamshire or Lancashire. A community, a very tight-knit community, experienced a trauma. One consequence of it, I think, in Wales, and this is perhaps more controversial, is that in Wales, one result was that bright people fled, my father being one of them. It was a source of pride to my father's family, or my grandfather, that almost all his children got out, was the phrase. And I think that what was left behind was a sense of resentment and failure, covering not just individual families or individual villages and towns, but a sort of political community, which never let it go. And the result of that was this psychosis, which whenever I go to Cardiff, you just hear it all the time. It's unfair. We're maltreated. We're oppressed. You hear this phraseology, you just don't hear it in Liverpool or Newcastle or Southampton. And then it's overlaid with a sense of national insecurity and all these things, which Wales just doesn't hope, even since devolution, which was a great step forward for Wales. It really was. I mean, a moment of what should have been huge pride. It was a moment of pride, but it was not translated into what I think it should have been, which was a beacon of good devolved government on the west coast of Britain. But there was an opportunity in 2000, and I still think it was a good idea. I still think Welsh politics was really transformed by it. And it did stop complaining quite so much and become more self-reliant. The political identity did emerge from devolution and is still there, ready and waiting. It hasn't been a great success. The polls don't show the Welsh very, very convinced by it. But nonetheless, it was something worth doing, and it's done.
Would you be able to touch on a bit more on the historical reasons as you see them for that? I think you said national insecurity. That's quite an interesting term. What can you say about that?
I just think it's probably natural. I've tried to study roughly equivalent groups across Europe. Basques, Catalans, Bretons, the Walloons in Belgium, groups who for some reason feel they've never got a fair crack of the whip from some confederacy, which is what the United Kingdom is. And the complication is always that the best people in these communities tend to drift away from them to the more successful other end. There's a study or end of studies of rail links, or transport links, high-speed transport links, not least HS1 and 2, and TGV in France. Who do they benefit? They always benefit the more powerful end of the link. They always disbenefit the least powerful end. So TGV, in every case, is shown as having benefited Paris. HS2 will benefit London, whatever anyone says. Dr. Johnson's happiest road out of Scotland is the road to England. And I'm afraid the same is true in Wales. I mean, you just see in communities I know reasonably well, the successful bright people have left. And it's heartbreaking to say so, but it's just true. And they've got to find a way of getting them back or replacing them. To get them back would be very difficult. In my experience, they come back, see their parents, they come back holidays, and perhaps they retire back, which is a very good thing. Perhaps they retire back. But the new blood, and this applies to certainly rural Wales, has got to come from newcomers. And those newcomers will mostly be English. And they've got to welcome them, make them feel at home, make them feel they can make some money there. And I just think it's critical. And I may say it's happening. I noticed, I think I'm right in saying, the two counties now, with the only two counties with an expanding population in Wales, are Powys and Ceredigion. And that's because of newcomers. So Wales needs to get over the thing you were describing, which is, I suppose, inevitable in ostensibly problem areas, and just get wise.
I'm interested to hear your thoughts on David Lloyd George, because you mentioned there's a sense of Wales in this period not necessarily getting a fair crack at the whip. But then we see at the very beginning of this century, we see the country's first Welsh Prime Minister. Surely that's a big sign of Wales being very integral to the Union's progress. What would you make of him as a character in this history?
I don't think Lloyd George is very relevant to it. I mean, he left Wales went back when dead. But I think in many ways Lloyd George was a classic Welshman, but no different from Gladstone was a classic Lancastrian. I mean, these people came from the provinces to London and did very well. The question for these provinces is, how do you not just suffer? How do you get them back? I mean, if you take Northern Portugal, it's worse than Wales. Northern Portugal is in desperate straits. Every single man, it's like Romania, comes to Britain or Germany or France. The hills are just depopulating. And you say, what's going to get them back? It's somebody who loves hills. And they will come back. The Sicilian hills are repopulating with North Africans, but they're repopulating. And I have no doubt at all that the penumbra of the Midlands extending into central Wales will be the revival of central Wales. It's going to come from outside. And in Cardiff, I mean, Cardiff is a transformed place from 10 years ago. You just see that, you think that. Cardiff just needs the most creative planning to create some areas of so to speak, Shoreditch. There just really aren't any. Big cities now need Shoreditches. And my father would have died, saying that. They could have been in the Welsh Valleys. But they demolished most of the bits of the old communities there, which would have been hubs. You're left with Cardiff. I'd love to see Bute Town rebuilt. They might get some of the old spirit of Bute Town there. But either way, you need to find a reason for people not to leave, to stay.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
The concept of one industry town or one industry region is not unique to Wales. What was unique to Wales was its difficulty in overcoming its decline.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
We've already talked about coal. And can we talk about the decline of this industry, what happened, and then how this has led to the exodus that you speak of?
Coal and related industries, I don't know when, but for the sake of the argument of the late 19th century, it was half the working population of Wales. It was gigantic. But it was no different from wool in Yorkshire or cotton in Lancashire or fish in Grimsby. The concept of one industry town or one industry region is not unique to Wales. What was unique to Wales was its difficulty in overcoming its decline. The decline of coal, really in the last 20 years since the great coal collapse, was indeed dramatic and traumatic and in all sorts of ways. It deserved almost a royal commission. What on earth are we going to do with these communities? Because we don't want them just to empty. In the American Midwest, they just emptied. And the Rust Belt just emptied. People went away. And you can go around these extraordinary mining towns and just see nothing. I think that would be a tragedy, not least because there's so many things these places could have done. They're quite close to Cardiff. They're close to a central population. They are up in the hills, not polluted and so on. My father always talked of going out of his backyard and walking up the hill. You don't get that in many poor communities or tenement communities. So the question of how you recover from coal was certainly moot. And at the time, it has to be said, everybody said, we've got to get inward investment. The Hoover factory came, and these lumpy investments came, which of course then left. You had to think in terms of these communities, in my view, as how can they support the nearest viable employment center. In the case of the Valleys, it's Cardiff and Swansea. How can you make Cardiff and Swansea really work? Well, you've got to try and make them places that people want to come to. People of talent want to come to, and people of talent want to stay. One of the keys to that is two good universities, which they've got. Another is an attractive place to hang out, frankly. You know, parts of Leeds have got it, the calls in Leeds. We've mentioned Hebden Bridge, the northern quarter of Manchester, becoming quite sort of funky. I mean, these, we laugh, you know, but these things matter. They just matter. And anyone would have said that, who said that Hoxton would one day be fashionable, would have been laughed out of court. It's fashionable.
I know we're talking predominantly about the economic decline here, but I think one thing you touched upon earlier is the cultural sense of Welshness, whether that's music, culture, sport. And I'm interested to hear your take on the role of culture in that.
Well, politics and economics are uncontroversial. Culture is not. I don't speak Welsh. I can say the place names. My father spoke it a bit. My grandfather didn't speak it a lot, although he was very Welsh. But so the Welsh fellows in those days were not Welsh speaking, I'm afraid. I'm not afraid either. They weren't. The two things I think on this. On the one hand, the Welsh language and culture is splendid. It's one of the great, what's called Celtic cultures of Europe. And it's alive. I've said that I've been to it. It's very exciting. You do sense a specialness about it. I love listening to the Penethlion and the special characteristics of this language and culture. Where I'm alarmed is simply at its imposition compulsorily on people who just are not a part of it. It is exactly what they claim the English did when they invaded Wales. It's no good taking very young children who do not speak Welsh, refusing to teach them any language other than Welsh. It is clearly holding them back, or it's clearly holding Welsh education back, which was thriving when Welsh was taught but not compulsorily. My father learned Welsh in school proudly. I think he'd now be forced to learn it angrily. And I just think it's the element of compulsion. It's the tricks like, you know, giving me official documents in which the Welsh is in black and the English is in red so I can't read it. I mean, silly things like that just infuriate people and, of course, divide them and deter outsiders from coming in. And I just think it's economically a bad idea, even if it's culturally a good idea.
So for Wales to get a sense of any economic recovery or prosperity, how would you see that affecting the movement towards Welsh language?
Well, Welsh language is claimed by 20% of the population. Other studies say probably half that speak it in any meaningful sense, and possibly far fewer at home. In other words, it's benefited from this compulsory culture of the public sector. So I don't think the language matters very much. I think nothing would do better for Welsh culture than the revival of the Welsh economy, confidence in Welsh towns and cities that they have a viable economic future, and people flocking to Wales because they want to be there, which is more than half the Welsh want to be because they're leaving. It's to make Welsh attractive in that sense. Almost all the people in Welsh language schools in Wales are English people who come to settle there. Hooray! Why ram it down other people's throats? So, I mean, I think that these things aren't separate. I think the culture of Wales, which is it's one of its most unique characteristics, is absolutely safe. It will not die out. The only thing that will die out is it will make it die out is if it's compulsory. I once said, I honestly think the best thing for the Welsh language is to ban it. the government must ban the Welsh language. It will flourish.
So around the middle of the century, we see this rise of nationalist politics. What can you say about what happened there?
Well, I mean, the conversion of a growing sense of Welsh cultural identity into a political phenomenon was very slow and gradual. And I think it was, in a sense, bedeviled all the time by a kind of romanticism, which kept harking back to the Corsair and Glyndwr and so on. Whenever I talk to my friend Jan Morris about this, she keeps saying, don't ignore the importance of myth and legend in national history. I said, no, but it would be quite nice if it had something to do with facts. But anyway, the emergence of it as a political movement, I think had a lot to do with Scottish nationalism emerging. And the early days of nationalism then got bound up in and trapped by the language question, which meant that a huge chunk of Welsh people were just alienated from it. They were not going to vote for a party that didn't speak their language. But more recently, because devolution has become the talk of the age, and I suppose because I am myself an instinctive nationalist, I mean, I mean that, I'm a nationalist. I'm not an internationalist in politics. And I've always believed that Ireland would eventually go, Northern Ireland and Scotland will eventually go. The question is, what would happen to Wales? It doesn't make sense for Wales to be an independent state in the sense of its political economy cutting off from England. Wales, to my mind, its entire future is built in its relationship with Lancashire, the Midlands, and the South West. It's got to see itself that way. The idea of it being a bubble off the west coast of England is just unrealistic. It's not. I think to that extent, Plaid Cymru, which is a party whose sort of overall ambitions I support, I think the idea of Wales acquiring a political identity which relates to geography is helpful, as it was when Ireland went independent of England. What is not helpful is to think that it can become, it could have a border. It's not realistic. It must apply to what I think the Scots now call independence light. But I think independence light for Wales, which means foregoing English subsidies, but generating a new fiscal structure for Wales and devising new attractions to get people to want to go and live there, not industries to move there, people to want to go and live there, because people are industries ultimately, is a viable way forward. And I'm always quite surprised when Plaid Cymru leaders feel obliged to say, we want full independence. It doesn't mean anything.
I'm hesitant to use such a simple phrase, but I'm trying to think what I can say. Is there any particular historical aspect or resentment that you think is most important for Wales to get over?
Well, I think Wales has to get over England. It really has to. England treated it terribly badly, but it was in the 13th century. I once was talking to the Welsh Minister of Culture at the time about how undersold I thought the great castles of Wales, which are the greatest collection of castles in Europe, were at the time. He looked at me incredulous. He said, why should we give publicity to English castles? I could not believe I was hearing this from someone in charge of tourism. That's the problem. If you hate your neighbour that much, you ain't going to get any help from them in the long term. And I think if Wales could get over England and become Wales again, it would do nothing but good.
How do you think then, if we can talk in general terms of countries of Wales getting over England, how do you think England perceives Wales at the moment?
It was very interesting. I did a book on English history about 5 years ago, and complaints came in. Why have you done it on England, not Wales and Scotland for that matter? And I said, because it happens to the history of England. And they said, well, can't you be more broad? And no, it's a history book about England. And I'll tell you one thing, English people are not the slightest bit interested in Wales. They're mildly interested in Scotland, largely because of Mary, Queen of Scots, Macbeth. No one has a clue about Wales. And I said, how many English people know about Harold Dar? How many really know about Llywelyn the Great? They might as well be in Arabia. Now, that's a fault of English education. But it is the case that this is a very unknown part of territory. And it's one reason why, for instance, very few English tourists do not go to Wales as much as they should. It is really an unknown country. And I think that's why it is most crude. House prices in Wales are so much lower than they are in England. But I'm afraid the answer to your question is England is not very interested in Wales.
That was Simon Jenkins. His Radio 4 programme, Wales, a 20th Century Tragedy, will be broadcast at 8 p.m. on Monday, the 16th of March, and will also be available to stream afterwards. You can read a version of this interview in the March issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now and also includes features on Henry V, the Dark Ages, the Glencoe Massacre, and a Georgian terrorist plot. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Monday when Laura Spinney will be offering a historical perspective on the recent coronavirus outbreak.